Have you heard about Global Poker? Global Poker is the fastest growing card room in the US today, and it's available online at globalpoker.com. Global Poker is a social poker site that offers safe and secure cash out options by using their unique and patented sweepstakes model. Players can compete in big guaranteed tournaments, jackpot sit and goes, or cash games featuring Hold'em, Omaha, and even Crazy Pineapple. Don't wait. Check out Global Poker today.
Poker Stories is an audio series that features casual interviews with some of the game's best players and personalities. Each episode highlights a well-known figure in the poker world and dives deep into their favorite tales, both on and off the felt.
Welcome to Poker Stories, a podcast brought to you by Card Player, the poker authority, and hosted by me, Julio Rodriguez. This is episode number 94, featuring one of the top players on the high roller circuit, and perhaps even the best poker player out of Australia at the moment, Cale Burns. Cale is 31 years old, originally from Geelong, just outside of Melbourne. He picked up poker while in high school, and his success became too big to ignore while he was studying in college. For the first half of his career, he concentrated almost exclusively on cash games, just moving up to bigger and bigger limits, even flying to Vegas or Macau for months to find action. Although he really only started to play tournaments in 2016, he has already managed to win nearly $11 million on the live circuit, which is good enough for number two on Australia's all-time money list, just behind WSOP main event winner Joe Hashem. Burns' biggest score came in a 2017 Triton High Roller, where he finished third for $1.3 million. 2019 was his best year to date, finishing fifth in the Card Player POI race with 15 final tables, including four wins and two WSOP bracelets earned. He even started off 2020 with a huge win near his hometown, earning $1.2 million for the $100,000 buy-in high roller at the Aussie Millions, and then he quickly followed that up with a runner-up showing at the Super High Roller Bowl Australia for another $828,000. Anyway, that's enough intro. Here's my conversation with Cale Burns.
I am here with the one and only Cale Burns. Cale, how you doing?
Yeah, doing pretty good. How you doing?
Yeah, I'm doing great. I'm here in Las Vegas, where yep. You should be, but you're not. Where are you in this
the poker
time?
World should be, huh?
Yeah, exactly.
I'm in the UK at the moment.
Mm-hmm. And is that where you've been riding out the lockdown, or is it just a matter of getting somewhere where you can play online poker?
Yeah, a bit of both. Sort of killing two birds with one stone, I guess. But yeah, somewhere I can play online where the hours are somewhat friendly, I guess, even though I haven't been doing that much online. And yeah, riding out the lockdown here.
Yeah, for those who don't know, you are a native of Australia, and I'm wondering how much time you've been home recently, not only during the pandemic, but also before that, because, you know, online poker is illegal there.
Yeah, not much at all, to be honest. I think last year, I don't know, I wasn't home much. And yeah. Since this pandemic's been going on.
So what do you call home these days, or are you just living out of a suitcase?
Yeah, sort of been living out of a suitcase for the last year, I guess. Maybe spent a couple of months at home. Mm-hmm. And then the year before that, maybe 6 months at home. I'd like to spend more time in Australia, in Melbourne, where I'm living. I love Melbourne, but I know that's just not where the live tournaments are and there's no online poker. So what are you going to do? You got to follow the job, yeah. Right?
You got to follow the job, right? Well, let's get back to the beginning. Talk about how you found that job from Geelong, Australia, just outside of Melbourne. Yep. What were you getting into in Geelong?
Essentially, I was just studying at uni. I finished high school and I was like doing civil engineering.
You're skipping a lot there.
I finished high school.
Did you have any childhood interests?
Oh, childhood?
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, childhood. I don't know. Normal childhood. Bunch of sports, mucking around with my friends.
Yeah.
And yeah, I don't know. I guess school and stuff. But
So you wanted to be an engineer?
I don't know if I wanted to be an engineer. I guess I thought I would be good at it. I was sort of like, basically what happened was I finished high school and then I started studying civil engineering. Maybe a little bit of leaning on from my parents perhaps pushed me in that direction. Plus I knew it would have sort of suited my natural talents, I guess, of mathematics and stuff like that. But and then I was sort of playing poker on the side. I sort of discovered poker in high school, like just after high school finished. One of my friends was playing it. He was like doing pretty well. He's making a decent money online at like 50 NL and 100 NL. And he was like a smart guy and he was making a decent amount of money. And I thought, you know, if he's making some money in this game, poker, you know, maybe there's something to it. And so.
And that was your first, you know, interaction with poker? You hadn't like seen it on TV before that or anything?
I definitely seen it on television, and I remember briefly hearing that like Joe Hashem won like the main event. He's from Australia, right? And I was quite young at the time. It was 2005, so 15 years ago. I would have been 16, and I didn't really think much of it because I hadn't really played Texas Hold'em ever. I might have played like draw poker or something like that, but my parents always quite liked to play card games, but they didn't really play poker that much, to be honest. But they played a few card games and they played cribbage and stuff like that. And then, yeah, I just sort of started playing it on the side, like after I just played like a $10 home game once with my friends. That's how I got into it originally.
Yeah, they said you were a prolific play chips winner.
Well, I was a huge nit back in the day because I was like, man, I don't know, I'm scared to play for like real money because I don't know what I'm doing, right? In this poker, I'm very new to it. So I wanted to like sort of dip my toes in somewhere where I couldn't be, it couldn't hurt me financially, right? So I just started playing for play chips on PokerStars and stuff like that and started to do okay.
Yeah, so talk about moving up in limits and when you decided, hey, this could be a career.
Okay, so first thing I did was I started playing for play chips and then maybe I ran up a couple of million of play chips and I started to play it like these pub poker events where maybe it would be free to buy in and you could win some money if you come first, or it'd be like a $10 buy-in or something really small like that. And then I started to do a little bit of study on the internet. You know, I looked up opening ranges and all these other things like that. And then I started to think, okay, I have an idea of the strategy of the way the game works now. Maybe it's time I can dip my toes into some small stakes. So I just started playing like $50 tables at the casino and that started to go okay. I started to pretty much win straight away. Everyone was pretty bad back in the days. This was like, I would have been 18, so that's 13 years ago. So,
yeah back then, ABC was good enough.
2007, yeah, just C-bet and being nit was like, get it done strategy back then. And yeah, I was like working at a bar part-time while I was at university and sort of just blowing my money on alcohol on the weekends and like playing poker on the side, supporting that alcohol blowing.
That's what college is for, right?
Yeah, so that's essentially what I was doing, and I didn't really think of it as something that could be like a long-term option. I just thought I could maybe pay my way through uni like this, and that'd be great, you know?
Yeah.
And then, I started to take it a bit more seriously after I realized.
Was there a particular event, win, or score where you said, okay, now I'm going to quit the job, and I'm going to focus on this? Or quitting school, even?
Yeah, I did drop out of university and decided I was going to take it more serious. I went on a decent downswing. I didn't even have much money, and I remember, and I wasn't taking it seriously at the time at all. I was probably playing two times a week and sort of, I don't know, supporting my lifestyle or whatever. Not that I was living a super extravagant lifestyle, having cheap drinks on the weekends with friends and sort of, I don't know, not going without, I guess. But I remember like going on a significant downswing and thinking to myself, okay, you're either going to start taking this seriously now and like put a lot of time into it, or you're just not going to play it if you're going to, you know, if you're not going to take it seriously. So I think that was like the turning point where I started to do really well. After that happened, I just started to do really well. I remember I had like a tournament score of, I think it was 35,000 Australian, and I didn't really play tournaments. I was a cash game player. So I would have like, can't remember when this was. It was a pretty long time ago, though. I probably doubled my bankroll then or something after that big downswing, maybe even more. And after that, it was sort of just steady sailing.
Yeah, so talk about you did play almost exclusively cash basically until 2016, I guess, is when you started concentrating on live tournaments.
Yeah.
But for you, it's all about finding, you know, the high stakes cash game, right?
Yeah, I mean, I've definitely played a lot more cash games and tournaments over my lifetime, and I still think I probably prefer playing a big live cash game over anything, to be honest. But mm-hmm. it just started to become hard to find games to play, to be honest. And you have to, unless you go to a place like Macau, where it's like there's not really much to do there at all, and you have to play really long sessions, like 50-hour sessions, 40-hour sessions, and stuff like that.
Well, you did that, right? I mean, you would go live in Macau for a month.
Yeah, I definitely used to do that for a period, but I don't think it's a super healthy lifestyle. It's not something that I'd recommend many people to do. And I don't know, like if I could just play good big cash games in Melbourne, Australia, I'd probably stay there like most of the year, but mm-hmm. that's just not the case. You've got to travel everywhere, and like even if you can get in, there's like politics and all this other stuff you have to deal with. And at the time, I started to like do okay in some tournaments, and one of the things I always liked about tournaments was you just get your tournament ticket printed and then you get a random table and that's just it. Anyone can play. There's not really any politics.
Yeah.
So I sort of always liked that.
You don't have to be schmoozy to the game organizer or make sure you don't win too much.
Yeah, all that sort of stuff. There's none of that in Macau whatsoever. Just in
case. Oh, no, not in the casinos, of course.
But yeah, all that sort of private game stuff, like you can play but you can't play sort of thing that happens in some other places, wasn't really much for me.
Yeah, so it's, you know, it sounds like you jumped into high rollers more out of a necessity to find action rather than out of ego or some need to be at the top.
Yeah, I guess like in 2016, I started to have some tournament results and I started to play a little bit online. Like I did like a scoop series or something. Mm-hmm. And I did pretty good in that, and I hadn't played much tournaments before that, so I did a little bit of homework on sort of some tournament theory, whereas prior to 2016 I hadn't really played much tournaments at all, so I didn't think I had any business sort of sitting there playing high rollers yeah. with a bunch of really good tournament players, you know.
Well, it's funny because
that game would have been like subpar for sure back yeah. then.
It's kind of funny because you look at your results and boom, late 2016 2017 happens, and all of a sudden you're in all of these high rollers, and people might go, oh, he came out of nowhere. But before that, you were already playing, you know, big nosebleed games in Macau, whale hunting, as it were. I'm wondering, because I heard you talk about this on another podcast about how you had to adjust cash game strategy when you're playing with some of these big businessmen. Where you're not necessarily playing the same way against them as you were other people at the table. I'm wondering if that skill that you developed helped you when you transitioned to high rollers and saw pretty much the same dynamic at the table.
Yeah, I guess I sort of, what I generally do when I play poker is if I don't have any information on somebody, I'll sort of take like a good baseline strategy for how I'm going to play. And mm-hmm. then as I pick up more and more information, I'll start to tweak my strategy, how I think it will work better versus my opponent. But yeah, I guess playing a lot of cash games, you see all sorts of people, and I definitely played with a lot of amateurs and stuff like that over my time. So I don't know, that's the sort of different types of businessmen, and there's different types of fish. Some of the businessmen in the high roller scenes are actually pretty savvy, I think. Like they mm-hmm. know how to play. They know how to play pretty decently. And there's certainly some of those people that play in the high-stake cash games that are businessmen. Like, for example, there was this guy, Macau, that when he first started playing, this guy was like one of the most fun I've ever had playing against somebody. So when mm-hmm. he first started playing, he was playing like 1K, 2K Hong Kong and 5K, 10K Hong Kong. And basically, he didn't know how to play much at all at the start. He was like learning as he went on the table. And he was like, he would do this thing where like he would like look at you and stare at you and try to get a read. And he'd like, he'd come across the table and like feel your pulse on your like wrist when he's in the hand. And then if he like thought he's sick, he'd be like, nah, like you got it. And he'd just muck. And then like you'd be tanking against him. He'd do a big bet and he'd just look at you and he'd just hold out his wrist so you can feel his pulse.
Yeah.
This guy was an absolute boss. Anyway, man. This guy had this rule where like at the start, he was really bad. Like he was just raising 4 or 5 off, calling big 3 bets out of position, any suited stuff he was in there. But he had this rule with the high stake players, who were all really sharp players, that if he wanted to see your cards, you had to show him. And you weren't allowed to play with him unless you agreed to this rule. So everyone agreed to the rule. But I remember coming back to Macau like after a couple of months, and that guy went from like playing any suited hand to a three bit out of position to like folding over pairs in a few months. It was like unbelievable how fast this guy learned. Obviously, yeah, if he's playing those like stakes that are that high, he's probably, you know, a pretty smart individual to begin with. He's clearly successful elsewhere, but
yeah. So yeah, these guys don't stay complete. Yeah, they don't stay complete fish forever, and it sounds like they're getting a high stakes education, which comes quickly.
Yeah, for sure. It's definitely an element of that. I mean, a lot of the businessmen that play either the high stakes tournaments or the high stakes cash games, they're generally pretty smart, pretty switched on individuals in their respective fields, and it doesn't take them long to learn something like poker compared to the average person, especially when they're generally surrounded by really strong players. So that they don't stay stupid for long, that's for sure.
Yeah. Did you find any intimidation at all when you started playing high rollers, or was it just a matter of, you know, same game, different faces?
I don't know about intimidation, like definitely a respect factor. And sometimes, like, especially when I was doing the tournaments, being aware that like this person's going to be playing better than me, and there's not much I can do about that. But like, I don't know, I think I have a pretty realistic approach to sort of where I fit into things and where my skills were at the time, and just try and play my best game pretty calmly.
Was there any growing pains along the way, or did you find that your game translated over pretty well right away?
I think at the start when I was playing these tournaments, like I would always try and, especially the high rolls, I used to always register at the start or like very early, because I was sort of aware that my short stack game is not as good as the best players. If I'm playing 20, 30 big blinds against these best players, they're just way better than me, and there's not really anything I can do about it. Where I definitely played a lot more deep stack poker than a lot of these players, considering I was playing cash games day in and day out. So I felt very comfortable at like 100 big blinds, 50 big blinds, like the deep stacks. But then as it got shorter, you know, obviously I'm not going to be winning against these best players back then. So I think I was just sort of aware of that. And I wouldn't go back when I first started. It's not like I'd see an all-star lineup and decide to jump in that high roller when I was playing. I'd sort of make sure, you know.
Yeah.
There were some people in there that I'd want to be playing with, right?
Right, I'm wondering, when you're playing in these high rollers, are you avoiding certain players? Are you targeting other players? Or is it just a matter of when the situation pops up, you deal with it as best you can?
Like what, now or back then?
Anytime. I mean, is it even good strategy to alter your game to target somebody who may be the weak spot of the table?
Like, yes and no. For example, I couldn't defend the big blind as wide versus like Linus Love as I could versus just some random fish, right? So I'm going to make those adjustments. Like if I have what I think a Nash defend strategy is, I'm going to just defend wider versus a bad player than I might aim against a super elite player. So I'm going to make some adjustments like that, obviously. But I don't really feel uncomfortable or over my head at all sitting with anybody now. Not that I don't think there's players that are better than me, but just... There's only so much edge the best players in the world can push against each other, in my opinion.
Well, that brings me to my next question, which is, obviously, it sounds like you have a mathematical background. You've obviously done work with solvers, and I'm sure your game has that strong fundamental base going for it. But how often do you deviate from that and throw in a live read, or are live reads even a thing anymore at that level?
I definitely think live reads are a thing. I just think that 98% of the time when I'm playing, they're not in the forefront of my decision in the hand. I think like most of the, in these high rollers that I'm generally playing now, like most of the players have, you know, like very good poker faces, so to speak. So you're not just like, oh, I saw Adrian Mateos or Stephen Chidwick do this. It's like, no, you didn't. So you sort of just have to play a good sound fundamental strategy against them. Like occasionally, it's not to say that you don't pick up stuff, because you do pick up stuff, but most of the time it's not necessarily a live read. It's more just betting patterns or like indiscrepancy in the frequencies and the way they play a hand, and that's sort of how you exploit your opponents. Like, sometimes you might get something against some people, and I would say I do have some stuff against some people, but against the best players in the world, there's not that much stuff you have in the term of live reads. But then, like, let's pretend you're playing some random 10K or something like that. You might pick up a lot more stuff and use it in your decision-making. For example, if you're playing the main event, the WSOP main event, you're probably going to pick up a pile of stuff that you can use, right?
Right.
Or you might have a read that you're not sure of, but you give it some weighting. So then you use your fundamentals and then you like slightly weight that read some percentage. At least that's the way I do it, unless it becomes more concrete.
What about giving off tells? Did you do any work on your own table image, how you present yourself to others?
Basically, whenever I'm in a hand, I think it depends like what stage you are at the tournament. If it's like early and there's not much chips in the pot, some people will just stare at you all the time and other people will sort of just be like joking around, not caring too much. Yeah. When it starts to get deep, I think people are sort of paying more attention and trying to be more consistent. And like if I'm involved in a big hand, I try and be pretty consistent in what I'm doing with my behavior. I wouldn't say I'm like perfect or impenetrable. I'm sure like sometimes I might give off some information, but judging by what I see, how I'm playing against the best players, it doesn't feel like people have tells on me, so to speak. And I don't necessarily think I have an amazing poker face or anything. It's just I think most of the best players in the world aren't generally tell-orientated to begin with. They're just like so strong in theory and exploiting people based on their betting patterns that that's sort of how they made their money and got to where they are.
Hmm. Well, let's talk about some of the success you've seen. Obviously, you know, there's no trophy at the end of a long cash game. So it's got to feel pretty good to win a bracelet and let alone two of them. What was that like? Was that like a bucket list thing for you or has it always been about the cash?
That's pretty much exactly how I described it. It's sort of like something that I would have liked to do. It wasn't something where it was like I go to bed thinking I need to win a bracelet. I pretty much never thought about it, but I'd always sort of thought, you know, it would be a shame to exit poker or like to like die and not win a bracelet or something, you know, given that I'm in this game and I'm playing tournaments.
You were coming to Vegas for years and then not even playing in the events, right?
Yeah, I mean, early, definitely up until maybe the last 3 or 4 years, I'd maybe like play the main or one or two other tournaments. And I just played cash games at the Bellagio pretty much primarily, or sometimes at Aria or wherever else, mostly Bellagio. Had the good limit hold'em. And then I just, like play the main or something. I thought that's what I was best spend my time doing.
Well, you said you're living out of your suitcase. Does that mean your bracelets are with you? Where do you keep them?
They're at home now. I went home for a little bit and they're just like sitting in a box in my house.
Yeah. No, you don't display them on a wall or in a trophy case?
No, I don't. They're under my bed essentially in like a drawer that slides out. That's part of
my
bed.
You have one for each wrist. You know what I'm saying?
I got to get the double bling on, you think?
You could really intimidate some of these people in the high rollers.
Yeah, I don't know.
Bring back the fashion. Okay, we got some questions to rapid fire if you're ready to go.
All right, let's do it.
Who's the best player we've never heard of?
The best player you've never heard of?
So somebody who just doesn't get the respect you think they should.
It's going to be like some online cash guy, 100%.
Sure.
I don't know, like, what online cash guys you've heard of. There's definitely a bunch of online cash guys that are, like, quite good that people don't really know who they are. I'm trying to think of what this guy's name is. It's like Jericho or something. I can't remember. He plays really well. There's a bunch of other people that just play like 1K and 2K. No, 2K and 5K on Stars. Nobody really knows who they are, and they seem to play quite well. I don't know who's coming to the top of my head.
Jericho, that's an interesting question.
I might get back to you on that.
All right. Let's talk about the biggest pot you've ever won or lost.
Jericho. What's this guy's name? The Jericho 2. That guy plays pretty good, and I don't think many people know who he is. There's a bunch of other people like 2K and stuff. Sorry, the biggest pot I've won and lost?
Ever won or lost, your choice.
It was...
I heard you tell the story about playing heads up with a guy in Australia.
Yeah, it was $1.6 million Australian.
Wow.
That was a big spot. I won, luckily.
So set this story up. What's the game? Who's your opponent? Why are you there?
It was in Sydney, and I was playing... Well, essentially, I went to Sydney, and there was like a... I heard there was a 200, 400 game on that was playing like four-handed. And I was in Melbourne, and Sydney's like a one-hour flight. So I was like, I'm going to go to Sydney and check this out. And then I got there, and the game wasn't running, but this guy was supposed to play this guy heads up for like a lot of money. Like, I don't know how much it was, 500,000 or a million or something. And I said...
Yeah.
But I was sort of getting some mixed information from some people. Some people saying this guy's playing him heads up or you can't play, and other people were saying other stuff. I didn't really know what was going on. So I said, I'm going to ask this guy if I can play. Supposedly some quite wealthy Chinese guy was playing this Sydney reg. I said, I'm going to ask this guy if I can play, and if he says no, I'm just going to leave.
Yeah, go ahead.
And then so I told the people that, and they said, oh, like, why don't you just let this guy play him heads up and all this stuff? And I was like, I'm just going to ask if I can play, and if he says no, I'm going to leave. Like, and then they like offered to like sell me a bit of action, and I just refused. I said, listen, if I got to play this three-handed game, I wasn't going to sell you any action, so I don't want to buy any action. I just want to try play. And then what ended up happening was I got to play this guy heads up. They just decided, all right, we'll give you our money and you can go play this guy heads up. And I was like, all right. And they got to buy some action. So it started out at like 200, 400, because they didn't have a bigger sign at where we were playing. It was like in some saloon. And then this guy just wanted to keep jacking the stakes. We thought we were going to play like 1K, 2K, which we did. But then he was just like, I don't know, he'd just like lose a certain amount of money, and then he'd just point his finger upwards and be like, like
more.
And he had a translator, and his translator would just be like, he wants to go higher. And I'll be like, okay. He did that a couple of times until essentially I was like, bro, I can't afford to go any higher, okay?
Yeah, even it's the best spot in the world.
Yeah, you're gonna tap us out in one hand if we keep going like higher. But yeah, I got in a really big hand versus this gentleman and was lucky enough to win.
So can you talk about the hand?
Yeah, I can remember the hand. It was like, so essentially he started targeting my limps a lot on the button. So I started to like limp some decent stuff to sort of limp raise him. So I think it was, I'm not sure if it was 2K, 4K. I think it was 2K, 4K at the time. But it might have been 3K. I think, anyway,
10 times what you thought you were playing.
I limp and he makes it 24K. And I have two queens. I make it 80K. And then he four bets to 280K with like essentially pot behind. And I called, and then the flop was King 7-7 rainbow.
Yuck.
And he just thinks for 10 seconds. He's like, I'm all in.
Oh.
And I thought about it for a long time because like it wasn't all my money in front of me for one. Not that that really affected my decision, but I was like, I think I have to call. I don't think he'd play aces or ace king this way. I think he'd just like bet smaller, or I don't think he'd really go all in. There's no real need. You sort of have the hand on lockdown if you do something like that. And I just remember thinking, I think I'm going to call. It's like a very large portion of the money that we had to play against him, but I'm going to call. And then I just remember thinking, if I call and I'm wrong, all these people who invested in me, and this guy shows me ace king, going to be like, this fucking retard called off all my money with two outs.
He's got two outs.
Yeah, but then I called, and the turn was an ace, and I'm just like, shower, that is the first card. And he like squeezes his cards, and my friend is watching, and he just goes, he's got Jack 10, he's dead.
Oh, yeah, because if he hits the queen, you fill up. Oh, wow.
Yeah. So, we held, and this guy didn't give a fuck pretty much. He just rebought straight away.
So that was 1.6 million?
Yeah, that's the biggest one by a decent amount.
Crazy, crazy. Well, I'm glad it ended up in your favor.
Yeah, me too.
What happens if that pot doesn't go your way? Are you still where you are at in your career, or
yeah,
grinding somewhere else?
No, it would be fine.
It'd be fine. All right.
I didn't have all the action. It would have been fine.
Speaking of which, what is the best swap or piece you've ever had of anybody?
Best piece I've ever had of somebody, or best swap I've ever had of somebody. actually had a piece of some other guy when he played that guy later on.
Yeah, I would assume that would be good.
That was really good. He did even better than I did versus him. So that was the best one.
All right, what was your largest non-poker wager?
Largest non-poker wager?
Yeah. You bet sports at all or pit bets?
Yeah, I think it was like 50K sports bet. I've had a couple of 50K sports bets.
All right. Any specific event or?
I might have had some that are bigger than that, but I didn't have all of it. But on my own money, 50K sports bet. I've had a couple of 50K sports bets on the UFC. One didn't go my way, and I probably binned a lot of other people on it. And I think I had 50K on Max Holloway versus Brian Ortega. That went well.
Okay. Yeah.
I got the average price like $2 as well. Or maybe not $2, maybe like $1.90, something ridiculous. He started at $1.77, and I just thought, this is already good. And then he come out to $2. So that's plus 100 for you Americans.
Yeah,
so he come out to plus 100. And he maybe started minus 130. And I thought minus 130 was good. And then it come out to plus 100. And I started betting it like minus 115. So I probably got average price minus 110 or minus 105. And I had like 50K on that. I think that was my biggest sports bet.
Yeah, but even that, you're doing it with a perceived edge, right? You're not firing out crazy bets.
Yeah, I'm definitely not blindly firing.
Yeah.
I mean, I definitely get it wrong sometimes in UFC. I'd say I'm doing okay overall. I'm doing okay.
What is a talent you don't have?
The people that are as smart as me or even smarter, so that helps. Was that, sorry?
What is a talent you don't have that you wish you did?
That I wish I did? Okay. Yeah. I thought you were just going to end it don't have, and I was going to say I'm a fucking terrible singer. Like your ears would bleed. But that I wish I did have? Okay.
So you don't want to be a good singer?
Oh, it's just that now that changes my answer. I'd rather have other things more. Okay. One of the things I wish I had is I wish I could speak another language fluently. So I didn't really concentrate on language when I was younger. Like I moved around to a few different schools and like primary school and stuff like that. And it was fucking different language with them. And I didn't really take the one I did seriously at high school. So I wish I could speak another language fluently. I feel like a lot of us English speakers are pretty lazy in that respect. Like a lot of Europeans are fluent in their language, fluent in English, and sometimes fluent in another language. And yeah, so I started learning Spanish a little bit recently. I'm not great. I can maybe speak 600 words or 650 words or something at the moment, but
that's not a start. Bad.
Yeah, it's a start. Yeah,
if you got lost in Mexico, you could probably find your way back.
Yeah, I can find my way back. Also, like learn an instrument, so I can't play an instrument either. So that's one of my regrets for sure, a talent that I wish I had.
You know, I learned an instrument growing up. I played 8 years of trombone. And if you handed me one today, I don't think I could tell you anything about it.
No shit.
So yeah, it's one of those things you got to keep on or else it goes away for sure.
Yeah, true.
Do you have a celebrity doppelganger, or growing up, did people tell you you look like somebody famous?
I remember like I got a couple of these when I was young, like for some reason when I was quite young. Like, I don't know why, but there was some guy that was like, this is when I was a kid, like 12, but I don't know if it's necessarily true. People
did
think
you have
like
the shaggy haircut?
Pardon?
Did you have the shaggy hair back then?
Not really. My hair's curly naturally, so
yeah. I saw some pictures of you when I was younger.
I let it grow, it would have grown to like an afro. So I generally don't do that. When I was like 12, they used to say I look like that guy, that kid from Malcolm in the Middle, the star Malcolm. And then
Frankie Muniz.
That guy. When I was like maybe 12 years old.
All right.
Some people used to say I look like him when I was 12, but I don't know about now. I don't really cop it now.
Wow. Whatever happened to Frankie Muniz?
I don't know.
Wow. Okay. I'll have to do a deep dive on him later.
I think he did really well.
What?
Retired, right?
Oh, are you? I'm pretty sure he made all his money and then he just decided to get out of it. Are you superstitious at all?
No.
Like, you have no routines at all before an event, nothing you have to eat during the break. You don't grab the cards with the same hand every time. Lucky
chip protector? Not really. Maybe I'll be like, oh, this shirt's a bit lucky. I'll wear this. Or this one's unlucky. But I don't really actually think it at all. I'm just being stupid and I don't care. Like, I could wear any shirt.
Yeah, that's cool. It's in your mind, but you can dismiss it. That's good. Do you like telling people that you are a professional poker player? Like, what's the attitude in Australia?
I don't mind. I don't really care. Like, some people have great reactions to it. Some people have meh reactions to it. I think I have a pretty good way of explaining it to people so that they can sort of understand that it's not gambling per se. Yeah. Not pure gambling. You can make money. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
So I use what I call the Scrabble analogy. You know the game Scrabble or Words with Friends?
Yep.
So essentially what I say to people is, like, have you ever played Scrabble or Words with Friends? And 90% of the people will say, yes, I have. And then I'll say, okay. I'll be like, do you have, like, some friends that you're, like, clearly better at or clearly better at it than you? And they'll be like, yeah, of course. And I'll be like, okay. So if you play your friend who's better than you at Scrabble or you're better than them, like, and they just get vowels or trash tiles for the whole game so they can't make good words, like, they're going to have a really tough time and the worst player is going to beat them, right? But if you play them 1,000 times and you all get even tiles at the end, the person with the worst vocabulary who's worse at Scrabble has zero chance of beating you. And yeah, they go, that sort of makes sense. I'm like, yeah, so the tiles are like the luck element to poker. And if you play someone worse than you, they have zero chance to beat you in the long run. And they go, oh, I guess that makes a lot of sense. Well, assuming they're rational. If they're not rational, they just go, yeah, but it's gambling or some other nonsense.
And then you're like, well, we can't even have this conversation.
Yeah. It's like,
then you're like, have you ever heard of the stock market?
Yeah, there's a lot of things you can do. Yeah, have you ever heard of the stock market? It's a good one. I'd stop there. I'm like, you're right, bro, for sure.
You are currently number two on Australia's all-time money list, and I have to assume you will be number one very shortly, as soon as live poker starts up again. Is that important to you? Do you want to get to the top of that list? Fight Michael Adamo for a while?
I guess it would be nice to get to the top. I didn't really think about it much when I was playing. It's definitely, like, not a motivator in things. I'm, like, playing because I enjoy playing or, you know, want to be playing these high rolls. I'm not, like, chasing the number one on the Australian money list or anything. But I want to fight Michael Adamo forever. I don't know.
Well, it's going to be the two of you basically at the top for a while, I'm guessing.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know how long either of us plan to play. I don't think either of us plan to be playing, like, with the volume we are now when we're 40 or anything, for example. I don't think either of us do. And I don't think either of us are, like, fussed about that either, to be honest.
Well, you mentioned you didn't really notice when Joe Hashem won in Australia. Was there a poker player that you did look up to coming up or somebody you thought, I'd like to play that guy one day?
It's not that I didn't notice because I didn't even play poker or understand the poker world at all. I was like 16. Mm. And my experience with poker was playing like draw poker with my friends or my family. Like,
yeah.
Was there people that I looked up to? I mean, yeah, definitely when I was young, I looked up to people. Like, you'd see people, I don't know, Phil Ivey or like, I definitely remember seeing Isildur play, Victor Blom. I remember seeing him just play like 500, 1K. All the superstars heads up at the same time. And I was like, he was playing six tables at the time versus like Patrick Antonius, Phil Ivey, Tom Dwan. I don't know who else. It was like Brian Townsend and some other people. One table with Gila Liberté. It was at once and he was killing them. And I remember thinking like, I don't know who this guy is, but this is amazing what everyone's seeing right now. So I remember looking up to him for sure.
Do you have
a little bit to be desired, but in 10 out of 10 for heart.
Oh, for sure. For sure. Do you have a nemesis, someone you can't beat or someone who has always held over you?
I think like that just happens in like short periods. I think everybody will be like, I can't beat this person for some period and I can always beat this person. And like, it's just variance in my opinion, a lot of the time, like obviously some people are better than you and you can't really do much about that. But this, I feel like there'll be some people over a period where you just can't win it all in against them.
Yeah. They just have some reason.
There'll be other people where they can't win it all in against you. So I've definitely had stretches like that with some people, but like none that's super long lasting or anything. None that's just like lasted 5 years or anything like that.
Headphones on at the table, yes or no?
I do it sometimes, but I do think I probably have slightly more focus with headphones off. That's me. Yeah. Just because I can hear a little bit of table chatter and stuff like that, and maybe you miss a little bit of information sometimes.
But when you are wearing them, when you're wearing them, what are you listening to?
Well, I generally wear them when I play online, but then if I get in a really tough spot, I might pause the music, for example. I listen to different stuff. I've been listening to like a techno playlist at a decent amount when I'm playing online. I listen to all sorts of stuff though. Sometimes I'll listen to like Pink Floyd or like Metallica and stuff like that. And other times I'll just listen to like some techno or some other electronic music.
Do you have a favorite album?
Like favorite album of all time?
Yeah, it's a weird question to ask. Certain. I mean, you're 31. So you got
I do have a favorite album. Yeah. I mean, I'll have a collection of albums that would be my favorite albums. I think my favorite album, I'm a big Tool fan. I don't know if you heard of the band Tool.
Yeah, them and their 9-minute songs.
Yeah, exactly. So I think my favorite album is from them, maybe Lateralus. It's their album I really like.
The only thing that is in my head is Schism, but I'm trying to remember.
Yeah, that's from the album. Good song.
Okay, yeah. Let's see here. What about a favorite movie?
Favorite movie? I don't think I could pinpoint one movie that's my favorite. I could maybe say I got like, I don't know, some that would be in the top 10 or something like that.
Okay.
I really like the movie Goodfellas.
Oh, okay.
That's one of my favorite movies. Pulp Fiction's a good movie. American History X is a good movie.
What about gambling movies?
Oh, it's got to be Rounders, right?
Yeah.
It's the most realism out of all of them, right?
Yeah. When's the last time you saw it?
Maybe like 2 years ago. I've definitely watched it like 5 or 6 times. So I don't think I've watched any other Pokemon movie more than once. So that has to be the first one.
It's got to be it. All right. Do you have a pet peeve at the table, like a big pet peeve that'll just set you off?
That'll set me off. Peeve.
Well, what's the most annoying thing somebody could do or say at the table?
I don't like it when people don't show you how much chips they have. That pisses me off.
Oh, that's so annoying.
Like when you ask to see it and they won't show you. It's like, fuck you. Just show me your chips.
Just move your hand. You got me tilting just thinking back to certain situations I've been in. Just stubbornness. All right. Do you have a bold prediction for poker's future?
For poker's future?
Yeah.
It's interesting. I'm not sure what's going to happen with what's going on online right now. I feel like there's a finite amount of money in the community and they're doing a lot of stuff at once. And I feel like it's going to just siphon a lot of money out really quickly to certain individuals and the sites via rake. So I don't think that's very good. In terms of what's going to happen in poker future, I feel like online cash games are going to continue to dwindle and not be great. Like just because the threat of, you know.
Yeah.
Like obviously there's a big seat scripting issue for one. Two, there's the threat of like live assistance. I feel like live tournaments are always going to be good and they're sort of going to come, like they're always going to be alive, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Just due to the fact that you can't bum hunt people so hard and lots of people enjoy the thrill of going deep in a tournament. The structures sort of give amateurs more of a chance than cash games. Like in cash games, it's just 100 big blind stacks. The variance is so much less than tournaments that amateurs just get fleeced so fast. And whereas in tournaments, you know, there's a lot more variance and the stacks are shorter, so you push smaller edges. So I feel like tournaments are always going to be around and okay for a while. And, you know, poker's never going to die. There's new games will come along. Tournament poker will always be alive, in my opinion. I don't know. I think it's dependent on a couple of things. I think, like, the economy changes, like, how the state of poker a lot. For example, like this COVID-19 stuff, if a lot of people don't have jobs, I don't think that's going to be particularly great for poker. Or it's a lot of unemployment, lack of job security. I don't think that's going to be great for poker.
Does that effect trickle up to the high rollers?
Pardon?
I'm saying, does that effect trickle up to the high rollers? Or are they immune from that because of...
Well, it depends. Like the super high rollers is just like a niche group of elite tournament players and super wealthy businessmen that are generally pretty smart that are playing for fun. So I don't necessarily think it'll affect that too much. But what it will do is there's like a huge midsection underneath that that it sort of just eats into, and it neglects everybody a chance to get up there in the first place. It would be like if you were playing at a casino and you wanted to jump up the cash game ranks and you had 1, 2, 2, 4, 3, 6, and then you had 100, 200. It's sort of not like that, but like, it makes it really hard for these like 5Ks, 10Ks, 25Ks to run as consistently, in my opinion.
Yeah.
Just because it's taking a lot of disposable income away. That's what I think anyway.
Article idea. Death of poker's middle class. All right. You've had a lot of success in live tournaments. It's big wins. I'm wondering what was the close call that hurt the most? What was the most painful close finish?
I don't know. Like, I've definitely had thirds and seconds or whatever, but I don't really look back and go, man, that fucking sucked. I got second. Like, poor me, I got second. Like, I don't know. I don't think that at all, to be honest. I spend 0 minutes thinking about that. Like, at the time when it happens, like, you're like, oh, that sucks, so close, blah, 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 right? But I don't know how you can look back on that and have it fucking taunt you. Like, maybe if you got fucked in some super huge spot and, like, you were – I don't know, because it's weird, because I'm playing these high rollers. I'm sort of playing 25Ks and whatever all the time with the same people. Do you know what I mean? So you're going to bubble these things, or you're going to whatever, but there's no just like enormous, enormous spot I've been in that's just sort of dwarfed everything else, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
Like, I imagine if you were some mid-stakes grinder and then, like, I don't know, what was that guy that got aces in versus Will Kasus Kings in the – that's probably not even fair, but, like, imagine being on the final table bubble of WSOP and you got an aces versus Kings and lost or something, right? Like, that's got to stay with you, surely. That'd probably stay with me, right? But I Griffin don't know. Griffin Benger. If he got fucked there, that would
– Yeah.
Or if anybody was in that spot and they just played, like, 10Ks and 5Ks all the time, or I don't know. Maybe that's
not Connor,
any normal person that played mid-stakes got fucked there, that's got to be a career-defining shit spot for them, I'd imagine. Yeah,
Connor Drynan losing aces to aces in the million-dollar buy-in tournament.
That was completely fucked. Poor Drynan. He took it like a champ, too.
Yeah. Losing to aces is so brutal. All right. We end the podcast the same way every time with a question from the random question generator.
Okay.
And here we go. Have you ever been in a fight?
Yeah, plenty. But most of them, I was quite young. Like, I can think of the amount of fist fights I've been in, like, after 18 is probably 3 or less or something. And
all right, tell me about
one of them. Wasn't even a fight because I just got jumped by 4 people.
Well, that's not good.
And I got one on the football field, I can remember, which was like fair enough. But I got into heaps when I was young, like in high school and primary school. I got into a bunch.
Was this of your own doing, or were you being picked on? Or
I didn't like start fights per se. But if someone gave me attitude, I'd just give them back attitude, and I wouldn't back down. Yeah. If that makes sense. But I wouldn't like go out of my way to start violence with anybody ever. No way. But yeah, I don't know. I talked back and I had some attitude in high school, put it that way. So,
were there any particularly painful ones?
Any particularly painful fights?
Yeah.
Nah, not really. I don't know. They weren't like super violent where someone was, I don't know, got maimed or stabbed or like had serious concussions or something like that. They were just like, I don't know, teenager punch-ons and shit, you know? They didn't go too far. Well, I mean, the only one that went far was when these people jumped me one time. Like, I was with my ex-girlfriend, and we just, funnily enough, we just got finished watching that movie 21 Jump Street. And then, before I got jumped, and then essentially we were like walking back to my car, and this car was like on the road next to us, and they said like, nice tits to my girlfriend. And I didn't take kindly to that. So I like, I don't know, I spat in the direction of the car. I just got angry. I was like, fuck you guys. Like, that's what I think of you. Do you know what I mean? And then we turned the corner, and just like four guys got out of the car. Like two got in front of me and two got behind me. And there's Jumbie. Yeah. They were definitely going around like looking to fight somebody. But yeah.
did your ex have any sympathy for defending her honor?
Yeah. But they knocked me out. Like, I just woke up, and they were actually bashing somebody else when I woke up.
Brutal. Yeah. Well, yes. I'm glad you now, you know, you get to spend your days at the poker table where none of that aggressiveness exists and everyone is nice and happy all the time.
Yeah.
No fights whatsoever.
Much more chill. Kale, I mean, it's not like a much of that, though.
For sure. Kale, thank you so much for coming on the podcast and sharing your stories.
No problem.
That's it. That is the show. Thank you once again to Kale. Go follow him on Twitter at RoffleShove. That's R-O-F-L Shove. You can also follow us on Twitter at CardPlayerMedia or at Poker_Stories. Go ahead and subscribe, give us 5 stars, or write us a nice review. You can do it right on your phone, in your app. Just scroll to the bottom. If you do all that, tell us about it with an email to pokerstories@cardplayer.com, and we'll give you a free digital subscription to Card Player Magazine. Thanks for listening.